The following shiur is being recorded for TorahDownloads.com, a project of the Yehuda Mann Foundation, Le'ilui Nishmas Yehuda Aryeh ben Yoshua Yakir.
The general framework of the shiurim were to address questions that people might have, so-called the outside world, and to go through hashkafic issues. There was a list of questions, and all of them, it's a wide range of questions, dealing with a lot of different aspects, some internal issues in Yiddishkeit and some external issues. I'd like to give Akdama first, and I would like to thank the person who's with me because it's important to have a live audience, and he will ask occasionally questions if things are not clear or if in some way I'm not explaining myself well or if the questions lead on. I would also ask people if they would like to email questions, and then I could try to refer to them in other shiur. I'd like to spend this shiur to explain some of the issues that I think you might have with hashkafa type shiur. The first issue, I think, I would call it the paradox of the arch. An arch is a type of building. If you ever see in Eretz Yisrael, everything's built with arches. And it was described famously as a series of weakness supporting each other. In other words, if you take a look at the arch, if you look at a pile of bricks, they support each other. Every single brick is cemented into a place that supports the other brick and makes a lot of sense in terms of how it is standing. If you take a look at an arch, if you were to remove any one brick, then the whole thing would come crashing down. So you ask yourself, so how do you make an arch? If you just cement the rocks in place, some rock is going to, any rock that you cemented in place as an arch is usually not supported by the other side, and it will come crashing down. I had that feeling actually once in St. Louis when I saw the great arch. Your first question that you ask yourself is, how in the world did they build it? Because somewhere in the middle, the thing would have just fallen apart. And they actually, there is a way they built it. They built it with scaffolding on the inside and covered on the outside, and that's why it wasn't really an arch. It was supported every single step of the way internally, and then once it was finished, it can stand on its own. So the answer is, once you build a wooden support structure, scaffolding of sorts, you lay out the arch, and then it supports itself once it's in place. The same thing is true in Ashkafish stuff. There are always questions leading to questions. It's very hard to ever start in a single place. For instance, what do I know about Hashem? Well, where do I know it from? What in Torah is valid? Things in Torah, I'm learning it from Chazal, I'm learning it from the Rambam, so how do I know that's right? Can you argue with it? But I can't speak about the integrity of Torah without speaking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The problem is you always end up with something that needs a previous piece of information. So wherever we'll start is going to be the middle, because there were questions unanswered before, and it's only once you get a bigger picture that things kind of support themselves. So I will try to give first some basic nekudas. I think that's an important one. But in time, I hope that the structure as a whole will sort of reinforce each other and support each other. I would like to sort of demonstrate it a bit in the word itself of halacha and agada. Halacha refers to the part of Torah that is nigla, that's halacha, and the structure of that part of Torah is called halacha, which means to walk. When you walk, you can define discrete steps. Each step is a step, and this step came before that step, this step came after the other step. You can isolate each step very, very clearly. Agada comes from the word negida, which means to flow, like a river that flows. You see the motion, and you see the entire picture of motion, but it's very hard to get, you can't isolate this is the first flow, this is the second flow, this is the third flow, the river just keeps flowing. So Agada has in itself the beauty of seeing a sort of comprehensive picture, but it's very maddening because you can't ever isolate one piece and it be a self-contained, clearly defined piece. So that is a point about why it's going to be difficult to give those answers, those absolute points where each question itself can be answered without, in a sense, relying on other points. That's the first point I'd like to put down. The second point is the sense of the questions were that these are questions that other people ask you. People are now going, people go to university, people go to law school, people are working, people meet people in all sorts of settings, and some people are quite intelligent, quite bright, and they ask questions, and those questions bother us. The truth is the issue is twofold. A, we would like to save face it with other people. We don't want to meet people that are nice and intelligent and ask reasonable questions and we're kind of stupid. On the other hand, it sort of forces an awareness in us that, you know, we never thought about it. It is an issue and it's something that we need to deal with internally. So it's just like learning the Hilchis, Halachas of Kashrus. When you learn it and you're in a yeshiva, they have one meaning. When you're out there in a butcher store and you're a rabbi in a community, it has another meaning, and it comes alive and real when you're dealing with that, and it takes on a whole new meaning when it's l'maisa. So for us, who grew up from in yeshiva, these issues were kind of academic, they were interesting, once in a while somebody really has a curiosity about it, but by and large, it's not quote-unquote l'maisa. When we come out and people push us the wall a bit and kind of ask us uncomfortable questions, it starts becoming l'maisa. And so even though the questions are the questions that other people ask us, but we really need to provide a structure for ourselves in understanding and believing. Even if we can't always give an answer to another person, if we feel comfortable that we know an answer, then it is half the discomfort is gone. Well, we know the answer, but we can't give it over. The Rambam says that the Rambam Mor Nevuchim, when he speaks about Amuna, he makes a very, very important point, and he says you cannot believe that which you cannot define. If you ask a person what do you believe, and the person tells you, well, we don't think about Amuna, we just have Amuna Pshuta, the answer is that sentence is an absolutely meaningless sentence. It's like asking somebody if he thinks that Jumblebee is something good, and he says definitely, and when we ask him what Jumblebee is, and he says he has no idea. You cannot believe in something that doesn't have a clear definition. We don't have to prove it, and belief is usually for things that we can't prove, but we certainly have to define. So if we believe in God and we can't give a definition of what God is, then we don't believe in God. And we may have warm, cozy feelings about being protected and watched over, but we don't have any real sense of God, and therefore we can't believe in a God that we can't define. So some of the things we want to discuss will be just an understanding of what it is that our Amuna is. We talk about Mashiach. Well, what is Mashiach? He's wonderful, he's great, he's fantastic, we all hope for his coming. But that's not quite a meaningful definition. It means absolutely nothing. And therefore, in order to believe in Mashiach, we're going to have to define it and so on. I'd like to put down another point in regards to answering other people's questions. A lot of times especially people who work in Kiruv, will present the question with the following introduction. How do you answer a person who says, who asks the following? That is a question that's frequently asked. And the answer to that would be akin to the old Jewish mashal. Yes, Pinchas.
I didn't understand the whole, what exactly is the question that the Kiruv Rebbe...
Well, they will present the question, how do you answer the question of, how could God be good if he does bad? How could the Holocaust have happened?
Right.
And so on. They will ask any series of questions prefaced by, how do you answer the following question when someone asks it? That type of question is akin to the old Jewish joke where a wealthy man was shown around an orphanage, and the executive director was very good at, you know, drawing his tears, and he looked around. The kids are kind of very shabbily dressed and cold and so on and so forth. At the end of it, he's very moved, and he turns to the executive director and he says, listen, I would like to clothe these orphans. What size pants does an orphan wear? That's that is akin to that type of question. Questions and answers, the vast majority of questions and answers are not of the absolute objective type. Math is 100% absolute, probably because it's a system designed that way. 2 and 2 equals 4, because that's what the system was designed to give as an answer. So it's just like if you throw 4 balls or 3 balls, sorry, my Maratzis, how many balls to walk in a baseball? 4 balls and 3 strikes, right? So 3 strikes, you're out, is an absolute emes, simply because that's how it was defined. So math deals with absolutes because defined. Science deals with answers that should be absolutes. As far as we're concerned, we treat it as absolutes. And it therefore the world of proof, and there's only one answer, and you accept the answer whether you like it or not, if it meets the criteria of being reproducible and etc., etc. Once you start going out into the realm of ideas, they don't lend themselves to ready and easy proofs. Anyone who's a little sophisticated and is taking any college courses, 101, whether it's philosophy or law, anything like that, knows you can usually argue two sides of an argument. You certainly, it's very rare that you could conclusively argue on one side. What you do have is a quality that one would call the answer that is meaningful to a person. Chazal have a description of it, and it's called Misyashev al Libo. It says by Paro that when he dreamt his dream, he had tons of people that gave him all sorts of wonderful, wonderful pisronos, and he had no way to test them. They all hadn't, nothing had come true yet. And these were people that knew the music that Paro liked to hear. They were his employed as permanent wise people in Pisonos. And yet he said it wasn't Misyashev Alibo. Somewhere it did not satisfy him. The answers that satisfy a person have to be Misyashev Alibo. And people are different. What will speak well to one person does not speak well to another person. What speaks well to a young man does not speak well to an older person. Every single person needs an answer that's Misyashev Alibo. So the first question is not what is the answer, but the first, if you want to answer a person actually, you need to step into their shoes if it's possible, and you need to see the world the way they see it, and the pieces have to make sense. For instance, let's give an example. If somebody asks you about, let's say, Hilchos Nida, so to one person, the answer that this makes for a fresher relationship with a wife is a very, very plausible answer. Another person, it seems cheap psychology. The answer that dam is a pchina of din, and we don't want to mix din with chesed and stuff like that. Some people will eat it up and say, wow, this is the most fantastic thing I ever heard. Some people will think that you're a bit daft. And, you know, if you know, this doesn't begin to make sense. Which is the right answer? Whichever one is misyashev al alev. And therefore, understanding the people you're dealing with really makes a lot of difference. If your venue are rough, tough business people, practical people, mystical answers are not going to go very far. If you deal with artistic people, musical, mystical people, the mystical answers are what capture them. And the right or wrong, as long as the answer is a correct answer, the right answer is whichever one is misyashev alibo. So not always is the right answer, but it has to be misyashev alibo. What is important, however, when you speak to somebody, no matter whether the answer will make sense to them or not, is it misyashiv alibcha? Are you satisfied? Are you happy with it? And therefore, it's going to be important for us to get some sort of understanding for ourselves. Because if we don't get an understanding for ourselves, whatever canned answers you have, it's not going to work. It's like when you walk into a store and a person is trying to sell you a computer. If you have a sense that the person knows what he's talking about and he lives it and he's into it, it has ashpah. If you have a feeling that this person was taught a sales talk and he's just giving you canned answers, it will not be terribly meaningful. So almost more important, or prior to trying to understand what the other person will want, you are going to try to... It has to make sense to you. You don't have to share your answer, but you have to have a comfort level with whatever it is that you're talking about in order to get an answer across that will be meaningful to the person. There's a one more point about addressing other people's issues. And Chazal spoke about this also. The issue is, we spoke about different questions meaning different things to different people. If a person asks you how could God, if he's good, have made the Holocaust, if the person asking the question is a 15-year-old who doesn't want to come to Night Seder, and when you're pressing to him why he doesn't want to come, he says, well, I have trouble with God, because if God is good, how could he have had the Holocaust? That's one question. If the person is somebody who lived through it, lost his father, mother, wife, children, brothers and sisters, that's a very different question. And you don't have an answer for it, because you don't have the emotional input, or not input, I would say the validity, the emotional validity to answer that person. And you don't need to try to answer that person, because you can't. You don't know the answer for a person like that. A teacher once told me, it's a horrible story, but I guess people should know. There was a boy who never davened and kind of would slip out, and finally confronted him. This was an older high school boy. And the boy broke down and he told him, my father beats the living daylights out of me every day. And every day I prayed to God that he should stop him. And one day I told God, I'm going to give you a final chance, and if you don't stop him, this is over with. And he didn't stop him. He threw me down a flight of stairs. I don't have the answer for that kid. It's not an answer that can be given by someone who didn't go through it. And all you can say is, you can admire the person for strength as a Saiyan, but you can't have an answer. You don't have the tools for answering that. And a packaged answer by someone who doesn't have the emotional equivalent just doesn't exist. One more point about needing to know the answer for ourselves. I think Chazal pointed that out also in two places. It says that if Umas HaOlam come to Klal Yisrael, the first Rashi in Bereishis, It says, why does the Torah start with Bereishis, not a Chodesh Lechem? And Rashi says, because if the Umos Olam will come and say, Listim Atem, and so on and so forth, it says, you know, therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu created everything, and Bertzono, he takes it, Bertzono, he gives it, and so on and so forth. Now, the question is, what exactly is the purpose of that Rashi, or of the Bereishis? I mean, we try showing it to an Arab and see if that takes care of his problems. The Arab says, you guys stole the lamb from us. You say, ah, you forgot the Rashi and Bereishis. Here's Rashi and Bereishis with a Tanchuma and so on and so forth. Not going to help very much. So who's it answer for? It says in Chukas that about Choyku, it says, Umos Ha'olam Amonin Es Yisrael. Monin means to badger, to kind of mock. They mock Yisrael. What kind of stupidity is Faraduma thing? It just makes no sense whatsoever. So Rashi says it's a chok, Enoch HaRishus Lahar. Again, that's not an answer in any way to them. But for yourself, you need to have a degree of Yishuv Hadas. You need to understand the structure for yourself, even if it is not, even if you can't give it over. But knowing it for ourselves is important to be mechazik our own emuna. There is another point about dealing with questions and issues. It's really built on what we said before about the different types of approaches, the different types of resolutions to questions of this nature. In math, if somebody disproves you, you are disproven. In science, if somebody disproves you, you are disproven. All you need is one disproven. If I tell you that asbestos cannot burn, and I light a match or a torch or something and it burns, that thesis has been disproven. I could reword it and say it can burn, it does not burn except those conditions, but the proofs are very, very sharp. The Ramban says in his introduction to Mochamos that Torah is not something where there is a mofes chotech. A mofes chotech means an absolute proof. The word mofes meaning proof by extension. Chotech means that it completely cuts it. In other words, the proofs are absolute. Which means the following. People, for some reason, feel a desperation to answer questions. And they feel that if somebody raises a point on the world and the realm of Amunah or Torah that they can't answer, that their world is going to collapse, that that he's disproven Torah, or etc., etc. The problem with that is absolutely wrong. What it does do is, so people feel that desperate, they begin to pile wrong answers. So, for instance, if somebody comes along with a problem with evolution, and there's such a mad rush to produce answers, that even if the answers are woefully short of the question, we feel that we must pile them on, which creates a vicious circle, because down deep we know that the answers are not really terribly great. We become very emotional, and we try to answer the questions with a lot of heated invective. You know, what a terrible question, it's not sure, of course, it's stupidity, and just simply to cover up the fact that we don't have a really terribly good answer. And also, we shy away from it, etc., etc. There is nothing wrong in saying, this is a tough issue, and I don't have an answer now. Just like a person's relationship with his wife is not built on any one incident. You don't say, okay, so when a person is going out and meeting a person, he's trying out different things. Everything is like a red flag, yes, no. A person has a relationship, he's married 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. There's a context. There are issues within that context. Some of those issues can be resolved, will be resolved. Some issues will be resolved in the future. Some issues we won't see resolved. But we're not dealing with a point-by-point thing. Torah has established itself in our minds and hearts with 1,001 leads. And we'll speak about a lot of how it established itself. the fact that there are issues here and there, and we should be honest about it. If we don't have a good answer, so we don't have a good answer. But there's no implication, there should not be any implication, that if we don't have a good answer, then we have to throw out our talis and tefillin, and we must eat treif, and forget about Torah. That's silly. We can assume the trust that we have because of everything else, and we'll say, you know, at some point we'll come back to this, we'll have a clear understanding, and so on. One more issue before we start with the Inyanim V'Emunah themselves is the following. It's a lesson that the Rambam uses in some places. I think that Kedaitzin uses the same lesson, and it goes as follows. People ask you questions about Yiddishkeit that you stammer and you fail at. Or if you give an answer, it's very long and convoluted, and it kind of shows up, and it's very, very, and you feel like a fool. And you ask yourself, well, why is it this person offers, for his position, brilliant, self-contained answers, and you can't do it yourself? So the word, the Rambam says in a few places, in Morah and the Akedah, they use something about a person's inability to understand necessary hakdamos. And let's discuss what that is. Let's say an aborigine arrives to civilization and he sees a computer and he asks somebody, what is that? And the person says, a computer. And he doesn't know what the computer, but computers do all sorts of exciting things. And he asks him, well, tell me how a computer works. So the first answer given to him is, it takes in data, it processes it, based on internal programs and programs given it, and then has a way of giving me the output, which is really a short, concise answer. And I could even throw in a little muscle to the aborigine and tell him, you know, it's like when you don't know how to treat some sort of wound or something, and you go to the local medicine man, and he's very wise, you tell him what's bothering you, he thinks a minute, tells you what to do, and you go and do it. So, that's good. Then he says, you know, is there like a little man inside? And I say, no. So, how does it work? I have to tell him, explain to me. At that point, the only way I could explain to him would require a whole bunch of academics that have actually nothing to do with the video the computer is showing. I need to tell him about electric circuits. I need to tell him about logical circuits, about AND gates and OR gates and NOR gates. I need to explain binary system. And I need to explain how I compile processing one on another. Those little, quote-unquote, little lectures are going to be dealing with topics, and the guy will say, well, you've spoken for 45 minutes, and it has nothing to do with how pushing a button on this plays a little video. And I tell them, yes, because the computer is a complex system built on A, B, C, D, E, and F. If you don't want to hear the hakdamas, or if you don't have the ability to absorb those hakdamas, then I cannot explain it to you. I can only give you that short definition of input of data, processing, and output. That's something I can relate to other things in the world. I can't. I can't relate Torah. If somebody comes in and CVS is selling a tchotchke, I can ask the guy, what does the tchotchke do? He can tell me it whistles, he can tell me it lights up, it massages your feet. If he needs to do more than that and start telling me, first I have to tell you about the inner force of the universe, it's not a tchotchke in CVS. A secular person deals with realities that are given to everyone else. We know what physical pain is. We know what physical pleasure is. We know what hurt is. And I could say this law is there for the purpose so that A doesn't hurt B, so that A doesn't cheat B. I don't need more hakdamas that I'm not aware of, because the hakdamas are common to any secular person. A secular meaning minus, it would include a religious person in the sense that just purely secular. But religion is built on a few layers of understanding. There's a belief in a God, in a certain conception of God that we'll speak about. There is the understanding of what life is. So if somebody asks me, how does Lulav and Esrog make for a better life? If in his world the only valid answers are, it makes your hands feel better, it makes your relationship with your wife stronger, or it helps you avoid paying taxes, those are only three things that make sense, then we have no answer. And the problem is, when you ask one question, you can't part on a dozen shurim about another world, another dimension, etc., 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 etc. It's not an acceptable answer. So understand that a lot of what is true to you, you may not be able to translate really to someone outside, because he does not have the hakdamos that are necessary, and does not have the it's not only the time and the patience to understand hakdamos. You can't pile on all the hakdamos you grew on in 5 minutes and expect a person expect to be credible. It's just not. These things are a span of experiences that require you to sit and to absorb and to live and so on and so forth. So you cannot always just immediately answer, you know, the quote-unquote real answer. You can, however, in time, develop a formula to explain that to a person. You can say, you know, some of the mitzvahs I can share with you because they really deal with the day-to-day things, and we can speak about it. We can speak about integrity of family and looking around and seeing what it's like when you don't respect with fidelity, etc. Some mitzvahs, you can say, it's part of a broader picture of relating to God in many ways. A little of an essay, you can say, it's a way of this represents the best of the fruit of Israel and a way of taking our best and praising God. More detail than that, I really couldn't go into. But understand why he can so eloquently explain his position to you, and you can explain so eloquently your position to him. You have the same hakdamas that he has. You have the same postulates and axioms about the world, and therefore, when he puts down a position, he can fairly eloquently present it to you. You have too many hakdamas to present it in your language. You will not succeed if you start explaining Lulav and Esrog in terms of ruchos and tlolos. You will step all over your feet. Your feet will be in your mouth. Your tongue will be all over the place. It's not. Understand that you can't give hakdamas in one shot. So, just to review briefly the points that we said. This, we dealt with an introduction to the topic of quote-unquote answering the questions in Emunah. We first of all spoke that the importance is for us a lot. It's when we come, these are issues that until we didn't clash with an outside world, these were not meaningful to us. And now we really want to rethink those issues because they started becoming a lot more lemaisa for us. We need to understand that unless we can clearly define hashkafic terms, we can't really believe in them, because you can't believe that which you can't define. The understanding that all of these questions, the answers are personal answers rather than purely objective answers. There may be answers that are wrong, but in the world of quote-unquote right answers, the answer that's right is the one that's misyashiv alev hashomea. It requires for yourself to have found a way of understanding it that's misyashiv alibcha, and it requires a sensitivity understanding for the other person that what what are the terms, ideas, metaphors, emotions that I'm going to speak to him. We made a point that if the other person's, that we have to know where the other person's questions are coming from. If they're coming from a deep emotion, experiential emotion, then it says, a miratzen adam b'shash kaiso, a minachman adam k'shemesim mutal afanav. You don't have the answer for the person whose emotional power is way beyond yours. We pointed out that having no answers is fine. Amuna doesn't rest on any one question, any one answer. It's a huge tapestry of understandings and beliefs. And the fact that there's a sort of a pyramid structure to it, and to a lot of it we need hakdamos, and that's why some of what we understand and believe will not make sense to an outsider. For the person who doesn't have rudimentary bases in electronics, a computer can only be understood in a very simple way. You cannot go past that. Any questions?
No.
Okay. So we'll hold here. Now. I think it worked. We will hope it worked.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm going to ask Jacob. No, I can actually try to put it onto the computer and see. It says if 36 minutes, 56 seconds, does it make sense?
Yeah.